polling is weird. Polling is a weird science slash art. And I think we could really kind of pull out some of the more interesting aspects without getting too, like, what are your models? Welcome to the Kambi Report. It is 190 days until the Vancouver municipal election. Time is rapidly ticking down, and tonight we have a real treat for you. Ian, Patrick, and myself, Matthew, have all decided to sit down with Mario Canseco, the head of research...
Co.
The head of research co.
It's a great name for a public opinion polling firm because he does research. And it's a company, so it's Research Co. Easy to remember.
Very informative. As was the interview, we've actually done it already and have just decided to sit down in a pub in downtown Vancouver.
On this wonderful Friday afternoon as everybody piles in to enjoy their afterward beers.
So in this interview, you'll hear us talk to Mario about his new company, about polling more generally. I know you had some great questions in there, Pat, about what's changed, what drove him to do this, how he thinks the different kind of models and techniques stack up.
And for the Vancouver Political Watchers out there, the most recent poll that just came out on the 9th, I believe.
Courtesy of his new company.
Courtesy of Research Co. is, you know, showing some very interesting results and has some very interesting implications for the Vancouver municipal political scene. So without further ado, please enjoy our interview with Mario Canseco. Take her away.
Well, Mario Canseco, welcome to Kambi Report. It's so good to have you with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're formerly with Insights West, and now you have a new company called Research Co. What is that?
Well, what I'm trying to do with Research Co. is focus more on the public-facing side of polling. I don't think there's enough that is being done with the care that is necessary, particularly on issues such as municipal elections or municipal matters. I do intend to do a lot of work related to elections, especially in a year like this one where we have all of the municipal elections in BC. We'll be having an election in Ontario fairly soon, election in Quebec, and take it to the United States. I mean, I was very happy to do some work in the US back in 2012 and back in 2016, and were very good numbers. And as far as what the actual voter vote was going to be, not the Electoral College, which is always a mess. And I'm just looking forward to having more time to do work on some of those projects that I really like and that I maybe didn't have time to do enough of them when I was at my former company.
So can you tell us a little bit about like what you were doing there and how this is different and like how you think the polling world would benefit from this in Vancouver?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the need for data that is actionable, things that people can look into and know that are actually true. I think one of the enemies of polling over the past few months and years has been the Insta-poll. You go to the website of a newspaper or the website of a news organization and you click on something and then somebody reports that data and tells you that 90% of people agree with what you agree on. And we've been having some difficulties as an industry dealing with that kind of material, partly because it's very attractive for the news organizations to just put something on their website. But
that's
the public...
When global or some news company will put on their website, do you agree with this bike lane? And then some pro-bike lane advocacy group or an anti-bike lane advocacy group will send out an email saying, go to this poll and hit it.
To hear what the bots think.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that's definitely the fairest way of putting it. when you have this scenario where somebody can hijack those polls. And there's a term that they use in the United States, which is freeping. Suddenly you find yourself in a situation where every single survey conducted, and this is something that actually happened a few years ago, every single survey conducted on the issue of same-sex marriage in Canada showed a tiny level of opposition to it after it became law. But when the Globe and Mail put it on the website, it was suddenly changed into 80% of people opposing same-sex marriage, which went completely against everything. And after they interviewed people and realized that there were a lot of non-Canadians who were taking the survey from wherever. I mean, this is before the Russian bot, so it's not as bad as the Facebook situation that we're facing right now. But it's one way in which you can influence those outcomes and then grab that soundbite, send it to your friends, and then somebody's having coffee on a Saturday morning saying, well, 80% of people actually want to ban same-sex marriage. I saw the survey.
How do you get a better panel of people rather than just letting people come to you? Are you still working with like the Insights West panel?
At this stage, I think there are several panels that you can use. I mean, I have used that one before, and it has worked very well for me. For the American stuff, for instance, we need to rely on some other vendors for some specific things that are very granular in other provinces. I like the idea of the online panel, but I think it's more about how you use it. It's not a question of the general population sample. I think one of the things that has made me successful in electoral forecasting over the past few years has been the ability to slice and dice the sample in a way that makes sense. You can talk to 1,000 Canadians, but if only 57% of them are voting, you're really talking to 570 voters. And are you actually learning enough about them? Did they vote in the last election? Have they done so before? Are they following campaigns? I think that's definitely some of the things that you need to analyze. And in the US, it's very simple because you're voting every 2 years for Congress. There's always an election in your state. We have more data points. You register as a Democrat, Republican, Independent. It's not that US elections are easy, but you have more data points to play with. And here, you're depending on the memory of people. Yeah, maybe I voted in that election. Who was the leader of the Liberals? I can't remember. Yeah. Was it Ignatieff? Was it Dion? You get into all sorts of confusion if you don't look at it plainly.
So, I blocked out large amounts of that period of my life.
So have the Liberals.
Yeah. Well, So I saw a bit of a Twitter argument between David Coletto of Abacus Research and Kito Magi of Main Street Polling, and they were arguing back and forth, I think it was yesterday, about IRV versus other polling mechanisms. So I guess first question I have is, what kind of polling method do you prefer or do you generally use? And sort of what are the options out there? Because I know that a lot of our listeners and a lot of the public don't really know much about polling. It's sort of a black box to them.
Well, I mean, going to the, and I follow them both on Twitter and I've been friendly with both of them, so I didn't particularly enjoy that fight. I think part of it has to do with the methodology being useful for what you need. So for instance, if you're doing writing level polling, it makes sense to do it by phone because there's not going to be an online panel with the granularity that you require. I've done some writing level polling in Vancouver Island, for instance, and some of the detriments of the phone, which is you can't find young people, you can't find people who have different interests in mind and you have to call in the afternoon, that doesn't happen in Vancouver Island because some of the districts that we were looking into were full of seniors.
Right.
So you're going to reach your quotas fairly simply, and it worked very well, and our clients were happy with it. Now, can you try to do something like that in a place like Vancouver? Well, probably you need more granularity, maybe use a little more of the online poll.
And when you're doing phone polling, just to like talk about that myth that everyone harps on about, is when we talk about phone polling, you're talking about phoning both cell phones and landlines,
yes,
and you balance that out in manners that...
Well, it's absolutely necessary. If you only do landlines, you're getting about a 9% response rate, which is negligible at best.
And especially if you're looking for 18 to 25-year-olds.
Well, one of the things
that... zero.
One of the things that happened to me, I don't have a landline at my home anymore, but when I did, nobody wanted to talk to me. I was part of the most boring demographic in the universe. I'm a man, 35 to 54. They've already spoken with enough of them. They wanted somebody younger or somebody older or somebody with a different gender. So even though I wanted to take part in the survey, I couldn't. And unless you incorporate the cell phone, it's going to be very difficult to reach that sample. Right. Now, the online panels work for larger populations. You can do a city, you can do a province, you can do the entire country because you're meeting your quotas in a much more specific way. But doing an online poll of, let's say, the federal riding of Vancouver South would be absolutely chaotic.
So... in terms of like what you would choose, I assume that there's some kind of trade-off that you make between the amount of money that you're willing to spend making, hundreds and hundreds of phone calls and, the ability of an online poll or an online panel to accomplish that somewhat more cheaply. So assuming there is no object in money, what would the...
An election.
I like where this is going.
You know, that thing that that always happens in politics where there's, completely free money for everyone. What would you choose to do to get the best result?
I'd say it would depend on the on the area that you're polling. I mean, definitely for a city, for a province, it makes more sense to do it online. I think if the panel is sufficiently engaged and you know how to deal with it when it comes to the voting intention and whether people are actually going to show up, it's still proven to be the best method. I think it was in the last election. When I was working for Insights West, we had a tie in the popular vote, and a lot of people thought we were crazy, and ultimately it was a tie in the popular vote, so that was kind of nice to have. But I think, you know, part of the difficulty would be in the kinds of questions that you want to do. And when you're doing something that is more related to public policy, doing it online makes a lot more sense. You get the time to read the statement. You get the time to disagree or agree with it. You can test other data banks. Doing a survey that has a lot of agree-disagree statements on the phone can be very lengthy. It gets tiresome for the people who are conducting it. It gets tiresome for the people who are taking it. So if you're testing a bunch of statements and are trying to figure out whether this message resonates with this particular group, doing it online is the best way to go.
There was a couple of years there where polling, I guess, where there was a public perception that polling had failed in a number of elections. You had 2013 in BC. You had the Ontario election where Kathleen Wynne came out. Ontario where Alberta where Alison Redford managed to pull the win out of the hat. Do you think pollsters got it wrong? Do you think pollsters were asking the wrong questions? Or do you think maybe there was a time where just demographically or structurally or technologically there were barriers to polling? And do you think that's changed now?
It
seems to be the last several elections, pollsters got it bang on every single time. And Kito Magda came out of the gates in 2015 and predicted a majority a week before the election. And
my favorite is the Alberta 2015 election where everyone's like,
where Eric Kearney was so happy.
Everyone's like, the NDP is going to get 40% of the vote. And everyone's like, no, that can't happen. So then it happens.
Yeah, so do you think something changed in that time? Or do you think something was off in that time? Or do you think just, you know, sometimes there are going to be misses?
I think there's two issues. One of them is polling as close to election day as you can. That's a lesson that we learned the hard way when I was with Angus Reith, because we didn't do that properly in BC 2013.
Yeah, because no one polled the last, like, 3 days of the election.
It was like Friday and then
and in
Tuesday
Alberta, it's actually something that can be traced back to the behavior of the people who were campaigning, because we come out of field. This didn't happen to me, because I wasn't polling. That's the weekend when my daughter was born, so I wasn't working. But ideally, they said, okay, we have good data on Friday. Let's not do anything anymore. And on Saturday, you had the Lake of Fire comments. Yep. You had the global warming is a myth. And then people in Alberta start to go, well, wait a minute. Do we really want to elect these guys? I mean, we're conservative and everything, but, you know, I think there are limits to what you want to do with your government. And a survey that I conducted afterwards showed that people made their minds in the final weekend. Some of them made their minds in the final day.
Ballot box.
Or right then and there. Yeah. So when you're polling as close to the election as you can, it works much better. Now, it's detrimental for the marketing aspect of the polling firm, because nobody's going to read it. That happened to us in the federal election of 2015. We had to put our results on the website at 5:15 p.m. because it's already going to be midnight in Newfoundland. And if you don't put your results before midnight in Newfoundland, then you get fined and you get sent to jail for a year.
Oh, because you can't put anything out on election day.
Right.
Interesting.
So technically, election day begins at midnight in Newfoundland. So you got to hurry and put the stuff out there.
You would think it would begin when polls open.
Well, yeah.
You would think.
You would think.
But there's also advance polls and mail-in ballots.
Well, but advance polls are a week before.
It doesn't really work. Yeah. It's just strange.
Our laws don't reflect the modern reality.
When I read their guidelines, I was terrified. It's like, okay, we have to do this.
You go to jail,
sooner rather than later. And a lot of people didn't see the survey. It helps for bragging rights the next day, and you say, hey, guess what? We said the Liberals were going to get 35% of the vote in BC, and they did.
Yep.
But for those next 6-7 hours, you have this situation where you're concerned about everything. And it was a massive departure from what everybody else was showing. We had pollsters who had a tie. We had pollsters who had the NDP ahead or the Conservatives ahead in BC. And it was, you know, are you telling me that they're going from 13% with Ignatieff to 35% with Trudeau? Yes, that's what I'm telling you. And ultimately, that's what happened. But can I tell you that 2 days before when everybody's calling me and asking me who's going to win? I can't.
So do you think the shift, we just mentioned the advance polling, do you think that there's been this heavy shift towards voters voting in advance? Do you think that's making it harder to do your job, or do you think it's not changing it? Or
I don't think it changes it that much. You know, what I try to do is ask people, have you voted, yes or no? If you voted, tell us how you voted, tell us why you voted. I think it's more interesting to me looking into the way campaigns are designed to not be out there every 3 days with numbers. It's right. a drain on your resources as a company, and it's also it's meaningless. You know, you're explaining a 3-point fluctuation in Atlantic Canada. Which is, when you look at it statistically, it means that somebody didn't answer the phone. But that's the story that the media wants to tell. So when we work with CTV in the last election, the idea was we'll do one horse race at the start, one horse race at the end, and a bunch of issues, because that's more interesting. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about childcare? How do you feel about the Kinder Morgan pipeline? Is this going to affect the way you vote? Are you happy with your government? Are there other things that they should be focusing on? It's more compelling for the newscast, and it's also better for you to understand how the campaign has been unfolding instead of just going, you know, they went from 41 to 40. Oh, man. Or they went from 40 to 39. Oh, this is terrible. They're on the downstream. No, that's all within margin. It's okay.
So you've come up with a recent release, a recent poll on the Vancouver municipal race, and it has some interesting numbers in it. One of the numbers that stood out for me is that 1 in 4, or 26% of respondents, think that the Green Party of Vancouver's current councillor, Adrienne Carr, would be a good choice if she became mayor of Vancouver. Now, this seems to be higher than some of the other people that you've polled on, like Jean Swanson in particular. But what do you think that means in terms of like her chances? Do you think the people thinking that she's a good choice can actually translate into people voting for her?
I think it might. I think part of the difficulty for the Greens is trying to establish themselves as a party that will run somebody for mayor. There's been this tradition of let's just have 2 or 3 candidates and see where we can take it from there. The fact that makes this so compelling for Adrienne Carr is that she does better with the over 55 crowd. And usually Green parties tend to do very well with the 18 to 34s, a little bit lower with Generation X, and then definitely low with boomers. And now you see baby boomers saying, we're tired of this. We're tired of the fighting. We're tired of, you know, Vision saying one thing and the NPA saying another and all of these fights and discussions. Maybe it's time to give somebody from the Green Party a chance to try to wrangle council. I think there's definitely an appeal there. And, you know, she was the top vote getter in the last council election, which is a bit of a tricky situation, because maybe she was the number 6 or 7 vote for somebody who voted full slate NPA or full slate Vision.
Which was your theory there, Matthew, there, yeah. was that, mm-hmm. yeah.
So it's, I mean, people like her, but if you look at it plainly, if you get the level of support that she got in the last election as a councillor, we're nowhere near there. And that's also part of the problem.
So if I could take a couple of steps back there and talk about more systemically, I mean, we're a municipal podcast. So what are the challenges and strengths of polling at a municipal level for a civic vote? Because I imagine most people are tuned out. You know, most people won't vote. So how do you go about that?
I think the number one issue is trying to figure out how much they're following the campaign. And, you know, we had this assumption because of what transpired in the elections that have not been correctly predicted in Canada. There was this assumption, well, let's just overweight the 55 and over vote, because that's the best way to go. And if you overweight the 55 and over vote, you counter the 18 to 34s who aren't going to show up. I don't believe that. I think it's more a matter of the level of excitement that the campaign can bring. It has more to do with that than your voting history. And that's why we got the election federally right, because, you know, we saw the level of excitement. We saw people who migrated from being NDP voters to Liberals, Greens to Liberals. The number one issue for many of them was that they didn't want a Conservative government anymore. And it worked out beautifully in that sense. And I think the situation here is going to be a little bit tougher on a municipal basis, because there's no incumbent. And usually you're measuring how people feel about the incumbent who is running. I think that facilitates some of the polling that was done in 2011 and also 2014. Now it's a completely different ballgame, because you no longer have those specific ways in which you can measure the strength of a party that is running. Now, not only we do not have an incumbent, we do not even have an incumbent party, because Vision is not running anybody.
Maybe.
Well, maybe, or at this particular stage.
Although some would say they are running someone, and well, she's in the race.
Yes.
But who knows?
Well, and we're at such an early stage that, sort of picking up on Matthew's question about Adrienne Carr coming off in that one question specifically, I assume all we can really say about the numbers you got on this first poll are these are the almost the like initial temperature rather than even And I think that's maybe why you didn't ask who would you vote for, but would this be a good choice or bad choice?
Yes. It's very problematic because you do get, right now you get a lot of undecideds on whether they would be a good choice. Now imagine the level of undecideds if we were asking, okay, if the election were held tomorrow, it would be too complex. The closest that I have come to this is polling for a primary election in the United States. And you do get, your level of undecideds at this stage is around 30, 35%. You're not convinced by anybody. And it becomes a question of name recognition, which is pretty much what we see here. Adrian Carr is well known. Gene Swanson is well known. The NPA contenders at this stage are not that well known. Some of the other independents that have been mentioned. So the challenge for them is, can I get to that level of name recognition and start to talk about policies that make sense? It's not unusual. When John Horgan became leader of the NDP, the first time we asked about his own performance, we had 40% of people saying, who is John Horgan?
Well, I found it interesting that even in deeper into your numbers, when you asked about the specific parties, 22% of people said they didn't know who the vision was.
The governing party for the last decade.
Yeah.
That shows you the level of engagement that sometimes we do not have with municipal politics, which I've always thought was strange. You know, you're more likely to complain about the premier or the prime minister and not understand how council works or how the mayor is elected. That's definitely part of the problem. I do remember the last time that I voted, somebody didn't know that they could vote for several councillors, and they were having a very heated discussion because she had already voted.
And she voted for one counselor.
But I voted for one counselor. Oh, no, but you have all this. Oh, I didn't know. And I can't give you your ballot back.
It says on the ballot.
Well, of course, but people don't read. Well, and so many things are there, right?
So do you think to dig into that question, we were just talking about that vision and their name recognition. If vision's name recognition is low, do you think that's a real advantage to them with Gregor? Because I imagine Gregor Robertson is that sort of that lightning rod. And if you remove that lightning rod, are they able to then put up and say that this is our team? And does that give them an easier pivot, do you think?
I think it's a concerted effort to do so. There was no preparation like the one that you have in other political parties to say, well, this is the heir apparent and this is the person who's going to be continuing. In a way, that's what made Linda Hebner so successful in Surrey. We have a lot of councillors, everything's fine, but this is the one who should follow me. And you got Diane Watts knocking on doors and saying, this is the future. And if you want to continue the legacy we built together, and you know, she won fairly handily against competition that thought they had a shot.
I think the competition, having come out of politics in Surrey for a bit, I think the competition in Surrey always thinks they have a shot and they never do.
Oh, yeah.
Or else Jeff Meggs was the person sort of second in line, but then...
I don't think he ever was. I think, not to editorialize, but I think that everyone that didn't like Vision thought that Jeff Meggs was the next guy in line. But I don't think he necessarily had the overriding intent to become mayor.
Okay.
Well, I don't think he's complaining about the gig he has now.
No.
But ultimately, I think part of the problem for Vision is the change in demographics. Their base was primarily young, first job, coming out of school, yes to the bike lanes, yes to helping the poor, yes to trying to solve homelessness. And now that base, after almost 10 years of the election, is now, I need daycare for my child, I need a bigger place to live, and housing affordability is a problem. I need to park my car because I can have my child in a bike. So suddenly the things that made Vision very nice when you were young, now that you're middle-aged, you're going, well, maybe it's time to do something different.
It's funny. I think that's almost exactly where I'm at. I was involved in Vision during the nomination race in 2008 for mayor. And at the time I was 23. Now I'm 33, married, looking to have kids, wanting to buy. And it definitely does change. I think you're right, is that there is that difference.
Give him a couple of years, he'll be voting NPA.
That's what they're hoping for.
Speaking of the NPA, the candidates that you've pulled on, Hector Bremner, Colleen Hardwick, John Cooper, Chris Hesquat, who I am unashamed to say I went, who? I'm one of those 61% that was unaware of who this is.
And Glenn Chernin.
Yes. all of them have relatively low name recognition between 6% for Hector Bremner at the top of things and within the margin of error of having any name recognition at all. So do you think that's a problem for them right now, given that they're in their nominations phase? Or do you think that just being part of the MPA will give the eventual nominee the boost that to levels of approval that an MPA candidate might affect or appreciate from like a default?
It helps to be the one person who is supported by a political party. I mean, we could say, the MPA has failed 3 times to win the mayoral race. But in any case, they still have councillors, they're still well-known, there's a structure there that is not going to be as easy to manage as it was 4 years ago, because you no longer have the corporate donations. It's going to be a war room that will probably have cold pizza and coffee from yesterday, because you no longer can replenish it the way in which you're used to run it. Now, that being said, you're the candidate for a party that is well established. Things can go definitely in a much better way. They're having their nomination fairly quickly, so I think that's definitely a good sign for them. But I think it all depends on what happens. Primaries and nomination battles tend to be very, very divisive. And you could be in a situation where somebody says, well, I don't want to support this candidate. And we've already seen a little bit of wrangling back and forth. I mean, these are the people that requested the information packages. Mm-hmm. Some of them haven't announced that they're running, and I'm sure they'll be making up their minds shortly. But being the one candidate for the MPA could help. You do have a lot of support in specific areas of the city, even though we do see that the negativity for the MPA is also a little bit higher than it used to be. But it's ultimately the goal of whoever becomes the mayoral candidate to try to change that. Suzanne Antut got a higher percentage of the vote than Peter Ladner, and Kirk LaPointe got a higher percentage of the vote than Suzanne Antut. So maybe that's what they're hoping for.
Do you have any idea of where that negativity for the NPA is coming from? Because it seemed like they were riding a bit of a wave after winning the by-election, even though, he was like first in a very divided field. But a lot of the narrative so far has been, this is the NPA's to lose. Have they already lost it?
No, I don't think that's the case. But I think reading too much into the by-election can be dangerous. Yeah. I remember April 2012, the NDP
Chilliwack
wins
by-election.
The NDP wins Chilliwack, and Trasolini's pretty much thinking that he's going to be the next minister of something because he had experience. And then two candidates who won that time, a year later, they lost the election.
Although there is an argument, I think, that by-election was something that people read into and changed. There's the analysis that the Conservative Party lost all of the wind in its sails the second the vote split caused the NDP to win Chilliwack. Because, if you're a right-of-center voter and you really hate the NDP and you see they're winning in Chilliwack, you really need to circle and get into the one team.
Right? Also, the BC Conservatives ate themselves after that.
Yes. They
completely.
Yes. clearly, we're all reading a matter of confidence.
It's been a very difficult time for them, definitely.
Yeah.
But there was a moment when it seemed like the stars were aligning and you
Absolutely.
Were having a situation that was going to work. Now, the other lesson from the by-election is don't have so many candidates from the center-left. If they had flipped the coin or try to figure out a way, and okay, we have 3 or 4 who think alike, let's just run 1 or 2 and get it over with. And that could happen here. I mean, imagine a mayoral race where Shauna Sylvester is an independent, where Adrian Carr decides she wants to do this, where you have a politician from the federal or the BC political scene saying, I want in as well, and then the NPA could win this election with 33-34% of the vote, maybe?
Exactly, a rematch. There was a rerun of the by-election.
Yes,
albeit
with a
possible.
Much higher voter turnout
yes.
than the one we had before.
So speaking of, we were just talking about that center-left. Where do voters stand? One city was interesting in your polling, because one city had, I think, 14% favorable, 11% unfavorable. And I have no idea how anybody can be really particularly unfavorable to a party that's never elected anyone to anything. But if they're 14 and 11, that's seems very low recognition. Where do you think they're rising, or do you think they're, where are they going?
I'll just say that I'm very unfavorable to the Christian Heritage Party.
Okay, fair point.
But
brand new party with,
Or rhinos. Rhinos never elected anything.
Yeah.
Even though they would be popular if we asked. I think part of the problem for one city is establishing themselves as a party that is more than one person. I think RJ has done a fantastic job creating something from scratch and building into some of the things that he's done before as an activist. But they weren't as successful in the last by-election. It's been difficult to try to strike a tone that is more meaningful. And it's also depending on what COPE does. If they run a couple of candidates, then you can cannibalize that sort of left of center vote in a way that doesn't work very well for them. I think that's what happened to the Greens in a way in the last election. If they had run two candidates instead of three, there would have been a better chance for somebody who was a Green member to go to the meetings with Adrian Carr.
Yeah. And then do you think COPE, we just brought up COPE, do you think that their recognition is outsized to their sort of political force that they are now? It seems to be maybe that they've got a recognition from your polling that is a legacy recognition rather than their current strength.
I think it is, partly because you see it doing a lot better with the over 55s. You see a lot of people who are younger who say, I don't know what COPE is. They're probably too young to remember who Larry Campbell was, even more remembering some of the other mayors of the past or some of the other candidates. And it's been a difficulty in trying to figure out who the next face is going to be. I think having Mina Wong as a mayoral candidate worked for them and definitely brought them a little bit of more appeal than they would have if they had run somebody else. But at the end of the election, it gives you 9% of the vote, which pretty much came more than anything from the vision side of things. And I think that was the first moment when you started to see people going against vision, maybe not at a level that was going to make them lose. But in an election like this one, 9% can be the difference between finishing first or fourth.
Absolutely. So with that, how much oxygen do you think there is on the left? How many parties? We have this sort of, we've now got Vision, center left. We've now got COPE left. We've now got One City, center left. We've got
Greens are
a bit all over the place, but they draw from the left as well. How many parties can the left? I mean, obviously Vancouver's it has a reputation as a lefty hippie city, but we're also
But it's also not.
Yeah, so exactly. How many parties can
depends
we actually?
Where you're walking.
How many parties can we sustain in with the voter base?
I think this is the great equalizer. We're going to come out of the election knowing exactly where this is going to go. People doubted that Vision was going to be the juggernaut that it ultimately became. And I think we could have a similar scenario. If you have one of these minor parties, or right now considered minor parties, that do remarkably well or get four or five seats and then strike some form of coalition to be able to run the city, then things could definitely work in their favor. But it's also because for the first time in a long time, you have a prime minister who's not conservative. You have a premier who is not a BC liberal. And the combination is exciting for people who want to see something done. Okay, now it's time to continue this. We don't want to have a mayor in the city who is going to be more akin to what the BC Liberals were doing.
Right.
Because they didn't do very well in the city. We could be looking at this. A couple of seats in Surrey are different, and we would still have Christy Clark as premier. So it was closer than a lot of people thought. But ideologically, it sends the message of it might be better to have somebody here who can work with John Horgan and Justin Trudeau if they can set their differences aside on other topics than to have somebody who is more conservative.
I'm trying to figure out a way to ask this question, and it's a question on accessible voters, what political parties can do with this data to determine where their voters might be accessible. Where they might want to direct their campaigns, and if you can maybe give me a little insight onto into how a political party or a candidate might use data like this to structure their campaign. So, for example, exactly the same amount of people think COPE is a good or a bad thing.
Some of them are the same people.
Yeah, it kind of boggles my mind that people have opinions anymore.
Just period.
Welcome to my world.
But for COPE, how would they take this data and plug it into their strategy meeting and look at the regions or the income levels and see where they might want to target their campaigns?
That's definitely part of the exercise for the political parties. I think if they can afford it and are doing it, they're probably making the same decisions. You look at the regional numbers, you look at the places where you're more likely to be connecting well. And it's the same structure with the data that is used to knock on doors on any other campaign. Right now we're going through this problem with the use of data on Facebook. And I think part of the discussion is happening because of the person who is in the White House right now. Because I remember back in 2008, the people who worked in the Obama campaign were lauded for their masterful way of slicing and dicing. And if you subscribe to Newsweek and watch MSNBC, we're more likely to knock on your door. The Trump campaign did the same thing. It's just that we got Barack Obama in 2008 and we got Donald Trump in 2016. So there's always that data mining aspect of it that is never going to go away unless the structure of the campaigns change. But more than anything, I think it's a reminder of what to do in the specific instances of the campaign. When you're looking into the way campaigns go, always look at the final week. You know, where is the mayoral candidate going? If you have the NPA mayoral candidate closing in the West Side or spending a lot of time on the West Side, it means he or she is trying to, you know, save the furniture. If you're going into places where you're not necessarily popular and everything is fine, then, well, you know, they have momentum in their sales and this is the way in which to do it. And it has an effect. I think part of the reason Trudeau did so well here is because he decided to close in North Van. That was the last memory before you headed to the voting booth the next day.
Or they're misreading their numbers, too, because...
Which can happen.
I think Adrian Dix was somewhere in the interior or Kelowna on the closing days of the election in 2013.
Yes.
It clearly was misreading the where things were going. Yeah, and so it's always fascinating to me when we always say, well, their internal numbers must say that this is working. And, well, maybe their internal numbers are wrong.
And it can happen. I mean, we've seen it in other elections in the past. It's more, and it's a different kind of situation because when you have that type of money at your disposal, you're doing right and level. I've only done it once in a campaign provincially, and it's disastrous in the sense that, you know, candidates go from 51 to 49 overnight, and they're panicking, and you're saying, look, very few people get this level of support, so please don't sweat it.
So are you going to be breaking down into different different regions of Vancouver throughout the election? Is you're going to be drilling down?
Yeah, I would like to do that. It's
what kind of sample size do you require for that?
400 is okay to look into east, west, and downtown.
Okay.
I'd like to do something that is a little bit bigger down the road. I think it's important. The problem, I think, is you can't really drill down into a neighborhood by neighborhood thing. I think this is better left to the professionals the next day.
Right.
We all enjoy Chad Skelton's map, so maybe we'll get a little more of those. But it's a difficult one. There's also that aspect of the media understanding what the survey can do. And, you know, I've been through that stage in federal campaigns where I get the phone call from the reporter in Richmond who is asking about who's going to win Richmond South. Well, I can't tell you that based on a national survey, let alone a BC survey. It's a completely different animal. But there's that tendency also from the media to look at it as, you know, tell me now who's going to win. I can't.
Looking at some of
the... You have to call Keto, who's like more, seems more willing to make predictions on.
Oh, yeah.
Individual writing.
To go out there.
Looking at some of those demographic data, there's a lot of trends that seem obvious. The NPA does well in the wealthy West End people and
West
the older
side.
People. West Side,
yeah,
not the West End. Cope does better with the poorer people. Did any demographic data jump out as sort of weird, besides, I guess, Adrian Carr, who we already talked on?
I think that was the most shocking finding, to see how well distributed the level of support or people who see her as a good choice was in the city. And I think it also sends the message that the Greens are no longer fringe.
Absolutely.
It used to be that way, but, you know, people did not take any issue with Elizabeth May being arrested next to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. They've been happy with Andrew Weaver. I mean, his numbers are not as good as they are for John Horgan when you ask people how they feel about him, but they're definitely not as low as what they were for Rich Coleman when we asked, or for Christy Clark when she was still around. So there's that movement of people going, well, yeah, you know, Greens have been okay.
So that brings up an interesting thing. People disliked Christy Clark and Rich Coleman and the BC Liberals, and they still went into the ballot box and voted for them.
Yeah.
And this has been something that has happened in BC for a long time, this sort of 10-second SoCred.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, where people will go in, vote, and then start complaining about the SoCreds immediately after. So do you think that that's something that factors in a municipal context as well? And how do you think that that would manifest itself?
I think it could, particularly because you're supplanting a bunch of councillors who are retiring. And you know, you have to assume that vision will run something closer to a full slate. Mm-hmm. You do have people who do not intend to retire and want to continue in council. I think the level of rejection for the parties is ultimately going to be measured greatly in how they react to the council candidates. If Raymond Louis is returned to council, but he's 15,000 votes behind his total the last election, and he's getting there as a number 7 person instead of the number 2 person, that's when it gets interesting.
Similar to Jeff Meigs' last election, I guess.
Right.
He narrowly slid in.
Yeah, we were waiting, and there was a moment when the other Robertson, who was running for the MPA, yes, not the mayor, they were switching back and forth before the final moment. So I think that's definitely part of it. There might be a moment to express your discontent with the way things are going by saying, I'm not going to support all of the candidates from the party. I mean, maybe I like one or two of my counselors, and that's fine, but I may not support the full slate the way I used to.
So do we want to round this up by talking about sort of the general voter and where they're standing? Is I mentioned in a podcast, one of our podcasts earlier, I think I mentioned that I don't know if there's any oxygen in the room for anything other than housing. Is that, do you think that's maybe the case, or do you think maybe there's space to still have environmental or other issues come to the table?
Well, we have seen it climb the charts consistently whenever we ask NBC, and most of this fear and really feeling of animosity towards governments is coming from the Lower Mainland, and in the Lower Mainland, it's coming mostly from Vancouver. So there's definitely two things at play. One of them is concerns with the growing base, people who are making different decisions about their lives and who are deciding where they're going to make it a go in this city after they're done with school or having their first job. But the other one, and I think that has been taken out, and it's going to be interesting to see who capitalizes on it, is the changing nature of the relationship between developers and the city governments and the city parties, which used to be pretty much very cozy. One of the things that we asked a few years ago was, do you think developers essentially own City Hall? And we got a lot of people to say, yeah, they kind of do. Now, that dynamic has changed.
With some money, now, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
The political contributions being barred now.
You no longer have that scenario where you have pictures of people donating or attending fundraisers. It's going to be a very different campaign in that sense. But it also removes that layer of, you know, now it's more of a grassroots movement. And if you connect well on some ideas, it's going to be a lot better than just promising housing units or doing something that is not going to connect well with the voters. There's room for other ideas, definitely. The campaign is set by the media landscape. We spent 10 days before the last federal campaign talking about whether women should cover their faces in Quebec.
Yep.
And we haven't talked about it since.
There was one day, I think, when it was in federal court, but thankfully that story is gone. The last thing I really wanted to ask is sort of about where you're going next with Research Co. How frequently will you be looking at Vancouver? Are you going to look at things like Surrey or Burnaby, some of the other big municipalities that are facing some interesting races, and what else?
There's definitely a plan to do more stuff municipally. I think I'd like to do also the issue landscape. I think we've seen how housing is a big issue here, but the economy is a big issue in Alberta, for instance, when you're looking at the national survey. So maybe Burnaby, it's something different. Maybe Surrey is still worried about crime like they were 4 years ago. So trying to get a little bit more into that issue landscape and doing a little bit more of the political voting intention number as we get closer. But following what I've done over the past few years, which is let's not focus too much on the horse race. There's so many things at play. There are going to be much more compelling stories and much better data for anybody to look at. I mean, I don't know who else is going to be active in this space as far as having voting intention numbers, but you know, with the aggregators, with all of the discussions that we've had, it's nice to be right and to be able to say the next day that you know what the people in your city think. But it's more important to participate in the discussions and say, this is precisely what the voters have in mind and how they'll vote. I'll tell you 6 hours before Elections Canada or Elections BC tells me that I can't post that anymore.
All right. Well, to wrap up, I want to ask you a kind of unfair question. I'm not going to ask you who you think the mayor is going to be because it's too early for that. But other than housing, what issue do you think is going to dominate the campaign?
Transportation. We're still discussing what's going to happen with the Broadway subway line. There's many things at play, and everything becomes a story in the neighborhood sense, you know, Yale Town, can I park my car? What's going to happen with the bike lanes? What's going to happen with the viaducts? Like, people are going to be worried about how to get to school or work. And I think that's definitely the number two issue in my mind after housing will be transportation.
Makes sense.
Where can people find you on Twitter, and where can they follow your work, your
All
new
right.
work?
Twitter, I'm at Mario, and then long dash or underscore, what is it?
Underscore
Canseco. There's another Mario Canseco who took it before, and I couldn't get it back. But,
we'll
I do have a seal of approval, so you know it's me.
You've got the blue check mark?
I got the blue check mark.
I'm jealous.
It's a fairly simple process in a way.
The Twitter status.
Yes. I'm not going to lose
prestige.
It. And all of our service will be at researchco.ca.
Thank you so
That's
much.
That's fantastic.
Thank
My
you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so that was a really fun interview, guys.
Yeah, I was really interested by his poll number where it showed the strength of Adrian Carr among the older voters. I mean, we touched on that a bunch in there, so I don't think we need to beat that dead horse, but...
Absolutely.
I mean, it filled me with terror. I am filled with terror because it seems like Vancouver seems about ready to shrug its way into a disastrous Carr mayoral
I mean, you know, we don't know how Carr would govern necessarily. I mean, I know her voting record, and I know my opinions on it. But I would say I really enjoyed getting into the details on, like, why and how you poll. I think we oftentimes get really bogged down in this, like, concept that the pollsters get it right or wrong or whatever. But in reality, it's a fine science and an art, and it's really worth doing, and it's not wrong. I found that part of the conversation fascinating.
And I find Mario is very candid and willing to he loves politics so much. That's why he started Research Co. He wanted to do more of this kind of stuff. So I'm really excited to see what he does with this new company.
Yep.
As Insights West continues to do the grunt work of public opinion polling that I guess pays the bill. I guess that's a question we could have asked him. Like, how are you going to pay the bills if all you're doing is the fun stuff? But that's his job to figure out.
Well, I think we're going to have him on again. I think the talk we were having is it sounds like we're going to be able to bring Mario on a couple more times over the course of the municipal election, and that should be really exciting to watch that sort of horse race as things evolve.
Well, it seems like the audio has gotten just abysmal. So why don't we wrap it up here? We're going to be back in a couple of days with another interview. And we won't tell you exactly what's going to be quite yet, but
we're very excited for it. Don't forget to follow Mario Canseco on Twitter at Mario, I believe, underscore Canseco.
No, it's Mario underscore Canseco, not Mario, I believe, underscore Canseco.
We're going to register. No, we won't.
As well as on his website, which is?
researchco.ca. I want to give a huge shout out to everyone who's been leaving us reviews. I think we're up to 21 reviews on iTunes already, which is potentially more than your guys' podcast, and it's closing in on what Politico's has already. Like, this show is actually probably going to be bigger than both of ours.
Yeah, speaking of our podcast, Podkeep Our Land has a new episode out this week. We cover the exoneration of the Chilcotin Chiefs. We cover some energy politics stuff. We cover the theoretical nature of the Crown and the new appointment of lieutenant governors, along with some other interesting news bites.
And I believe Politico's put out a new episode today as well. We covered different things than we did.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Kinder Morgan, and then we have this really interesting interview with Kyla Lee, who's a criminal defense lawyer who represents people who get convicted with DUIs. But BC's got this really weird administrative system of dealing with these roadside
The immediate roadside prohibitions.
And so you can have your car taken away, but then if you try to get it back, you're into, like, legal limbo, so...
It was a really interesting interview to listen to. I listened to it on my way over to our Mario Canseco interview.
And I'll plug also our 80th episode, which was with Rob Shaw and Richard Zussman.
Another good one, yeah.
The authors behind Matter of Confidence. And that's just a good background on the last 7 years of BC politics. So check both those shows out. Check out our new website. Your feed may have updated and maybe put episode 3 in there twice, but you won't hear the anchor.fm plug anymore. If you have any trouble finding this podcast, let us know at kmbreport@gmail.com. But otherwise, we're kmbreport.ca, at kmbreport on Twitter, kmbreport on Facebook, and tell your friends about us.
Exactly. And so, with 190 days left until the ballots are cast, we are signing off. I am Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Moon.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Goodbye from the Canby Report.